Good evening, David. Welcome to the Space Show.
Welcome, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed.
What are your current research interests?
My interests at the moment very much depend on my recent retirement, but it's space weather. Although I've retired, I'm in fact very keeping up my interests, very concerned about space weather, particularly its outreach into the community. I feel that there is so much going on at the moment in space weather and will be going on for the next 10 to 15 years and possibly accelerate in the next 10 years, that I think there's so much that we can actually learn from that. So I'm very concerned that I keep up with what's going on and at the same time pass that on in a way which makes sense to me and hopefully to others in the community, because I believe if we understand what's going on with the sun and how that affects the systems either in space or down here on the Earth, I think it will humble us to some extent into realising how much we need to care for our environment and obviously the people within it.
You have obviously seen many, many changes over your career. What have been the highlights of some of the things you've seen?
Well, most definitely in terms of space weather, it's been the change in instrumentation. That is, instrumentation is now so much remote sensing than it has been in the past, and we have the ability to take measurements from satellites in space. So when we look at the aspects of solar changes, variations in the sun's atmosphere, we can do that in many different wavelengths these days, which we never did before. We were using ground stations to do all the measurements. Now we have a mixture of ground stations and space in-situ measurements which are coming online, and some which of course have been providing us with information for the last decade or more. But this has made a tremendous difference in what we can actually say is likely to happen to systems down here on Earth.
So ground observations are still important?
Almost definitely for ground truthing, and it gives you ability to make measurements over very long timescales too. And in the systems we're talking of, many of the changes will take place very slowly. I mean, one example that's current at the moment, of course, is the change in climate, or possible change in climate, which in our scales, we can't see it unless you've got very long-term measurements over decades, and if we had more than just a few decades, but actually over several hundred years and possibly thousands of years, we'd have a much better idea of what's actually happening at the moment.
Is there a link between activity on the sun and, the buzzword at the moment is global climate change?
That's a very difficult one to say. There's certainly some parts of the changing climate is, of course, due to the changes in the orbital arrangement between the Earth and the Sun. Of course, our climate is driven by the radiation from the Sun, but in terms of what we talk about climate change recently, we have got many different factors changing the environment and changing the climate, and there's of course there's a difficulty pinning down which ones are affecting and which ones are dominant. And of course, as we know, we're beginning to understand just what the human factor is in all that.
So you look at the ionosphere mainly, don't you, and the Ionospheric Prediction
Correct,
Service,
yeah.
and there is a linkage between what happens in the ionosphere and surface weather. Or is it only limited to the upper atmosphere?
It's mainly limited to the upper atmosphere. When the sun emits radiation, it does so in bursts. So we have radiation coming from what we call coronal mass ejections and flares with it on the sun's atmosphere.
A sort of a burp from the sun.
Exactly, yes. I mean, it's a burp is producing a whole cloud of plasma which is being ejected from the sun as a what we call a coronal mass ejection. This travels through space, and if that hits the Earth, and particularly the upper atmosphere, it will shake the magnetic field of the Earth and cause changes such as currents and fields within the magnetic field of the Earth, which can then give rise to changes in the upper atmosphere. And these changes make a big difference to various systems, terrestrial systems. These can be ionospherically driven or supported radio communications, surveillance systems, and then changes in the magnetic field can induce currents in terrestrial systems such as underwater submarine cables, power systems, power lines, and also it will affect the changes in the magnetic field which affect the measurement of magnetic measurements such as prospecting for minerals.
We often hear, at least I often have read about examples of the magnetospheric changes causing voltage things along pipelines in Canada and causing blackouts in North America. Can you cite some examples of those things happening in Australia? Or where those underwater events have been averted because of your predictions, perhaps?
I can quote two. In fact, in 2003, October, there was a major flare, one of the largest that's ever been recorded from the sun, and that changed the upper atmosphere and the ionosphere to such an extent that communications between light aircraft were reported as going missing, and we just couldn't communicate. That gave some difficulty to light aviation safety. And at the same time, satellites that are used by various organisations within Australia failed. And these are communications outside Australia to other countries and so on, which are pretty important to some of the activities that we conduct in Australia. The other aspect which I'd like to mention is that when it was in December last year, 2006, there was again a major burst of radiation from the sun, and unusually it was just about at the same frequency as the GPS signals from the GPS satellites. And as a consequence, there was a major signal coming from the sun, which then rather overshadowed the signal from GPS satellites, and in doing so, of course, made the accuracy of GPS considerably less than it would have been otherwise. And that that happened over a period of some 20 minutes to 2 hours, and as a consequence, a number of systems that would have depended on the high accuracy of GPS would have failed. Now, this has an implication for the future, because as we move, progress our technology, we're becoming more and more dependent on GPS systems, where we have very accurate measurements of and fine judgment between vehicles, between aircraft landing, aircraft in the sky, and so on. So we need to know very carefully what effect such bursts of radiation have on GPS systems.
Do you have any way of warning the users of GPS, particularly the high-end users such as aviation, that such an event has happened and therefore the system will be degraded?
Yep, I mean that's one of the whole aim of our ionospheric prediction service is to provide predictions of what's like to happen. I wish we could do it for several days ahead. Although we can, in general terms, do it for several days ahead. In terms of accuracy and some idea of the reality of a situation occurring like that, we can only do it some 1 to 2 days. But we can provide an understanding of what's likely to be happening on the sun, what bursts have actually happened on the sun, and then provide more feedback to the systems on Earth that may be affected by that. However, the actual radiation bursts that occurred last December, this is electromagnetic radiation, which of course we don't have time to actually warn people before. It's such a short time period from the actual event on the sun and its implication down here on Earth. But we can give some likelihood of such an event occurring through monitoring the sun's atmosphere and what's going on in there in terms of the congestion of magnetic fields and the fact that they may be storing up energy to the point where they suddenly burst.
We might point out at this stage that we're not talking, when we use the word radiation, we're not talking about the dreaded nuclear radiation.
No, quite. This is electromagnetic radiation, which is, it's in terms of if I can put it this way, that it's throwing a lot of energy into the upper atmosphere, and that's affecting various things that may be occurring in the upper atmosphere, such as ionisation of the upper atmosphere, which provides the ionosphere.
Mm. Well, what do you hope to do now that you're officially retiring?
Well, let me say that although I retire, it's in inverted commas. I am certainly losing some of the responsibilities that I have for the management of IPS, and I'm passing that on to younger people with new ideas, and that's going to be tremendous for the organisation. But I won't be losing my interest in space weather. My interest with space weather continue, and I will be doing what I can, as I said earlier, about reaching out to the public to try and provide what I hope is a form of talks that can give you an impression of what is going to happen on the sun and then how that affects us here on Earth. And also trying to see where we're going in the future, what we need to do to understand the influence of the sun and how it is going to affect systems down here. Not now, but not necessarily just now, but for the future as well.
You mentioned your interest in getting the word out to the public, you know, in public education. What steps are you taking to do that?
Well, a couple of years ago, we produced a document for the Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering, and also for the Australian Academy of Science, which was a space weather plan, and it had three particular aims. One was to provide a monitoring. It's a recommendation, three recommendations, basically. One was monitoring the space weather. We need to keep monitoring space weather to make sure we know what's happening. The other is to bring research groups together in order to make the most of what assets we have in order to go for the really important problems that we still have in understanding space weather. And the third was outreach into the public, so that the public and industry understands the implications of space weather on their systems. So I think there are many things that we have yet to do in space weather. My chance now is to actually promote that amongst the public. And when I say public, I don't mean just necessarily the everybody. I mean it'll be targeted at groups that are particularly interested, and particularly those such as industry who can be affected by such events.
Mm. Are there space weather predictions that are given on, or space weather reports that are sometimes given on news radio, ABC News Radio, are they useful? Who are they useful to?
There's many different people. We have already mentioned the pipeline authorities to avoid corrosion pipelines. There's the power lines and the possibilities these may fall over if there's too much of a current induced in them. But there's other systems such as radio communication systems, and these are everything from defence to light aircraft communications to simple amateur radio operators that may want to communicate, especially when we're talking about emergency management and people going into emergency situations where it's easy to set up high-frequency shortwave radio systems. It's cheap, portable, and getting there quickly for some emergency situation. So these are the sort of particular clients that we would have for ionospheric predictions.
Stepping back out into space again, the new STEREO spacecraft, the two spacecraft they've launched from the Earth, which are about the same distance from the Earth, looking at the Sun in two dimensions, are they going to be useful to the IPS?
Oh, extraordinarily useful, yes, in several ways. One, and the first most obvious, is you have two satellites, one in front of the Earth and one trailing the Earth. We're looking at something of a side view of the Sun, which gives us a chance of seeing what we call the coronal mass ejection from the Sun, which means that we can actually see this plasma cloud as it moves in the direction of the Earth. and it gives us a much clearer picture as to whether it's going to hit the Earth and affect us, and also we hope to give us some indication of the intensity of the magnetic field, intensity of the plasma itself, as to the intensity of the storm, the space weather storm on the Earth's atmosphere.
Of course, SOHO has been out there 1.5 million kilometres towards the Sun, 1% of the distance to the Sun, but it's a one-eyed view, hasn't it?
It's there, providing us with tremendous information. It's from the space weather point of view, it's providing us with science rather than the actual monitoring of the Sun in terms of what's going to happen at the moment. However, having said that, SOHO and its equivalent on Earth, GONG, the Global Oscillations Network Group, actually provides images from behind the Sun. These aren't high resolution at this stage, but they at least gives us some idea of what is coming round, rotating round with the Sun, and it gives us a view of what's going to happen in some days before what we could predict before. So both SOHO and GONG have gone a long way to providing us with information around the other side, the far side of the Sun, which gives us a clue as to how things are generating, developing, and maybe causing a real event of solar magnitude, solar storm event, as it comes round the limb of the Sun.
Just remind us how long it takes the Sun to rotate.
The Sun rotates around about 27 days, which allows us, we see about 14 days in front of us and then 14 days behind us.
Yes. So basically, and you could get 14 days advance notice of something coming around to our side.
Exactly, yes. And with stereo, as you mentioned just now, we'll be able to see a little bit further around the limb again in good detail, so we'll be able to see things before they get to the limb. And of course, if you imagine a hose pipe coming out from these hot spots on the Sun, the sunspot regions, the active regions, you can imagine these sweeping across, and if the Earth's in the way of that, that's what's going to affect us. So if we can see the origin of that hose pipe on the Sun before it gets round the limb, we've got a much better handle on what's going to happen when it actually starts facing the Earth and sweeping across our orbit.
A bit like standing on a lawn and trying to get out of the way of the sprinkler.
Yeah.
As it spins
and
around.
I can assure you, if you get hit by one, it's quite an event.
David, we've talked about some of your achievements, but I know there's a long list of other things you've done. Please tell us about them.
Well, there's a couple of other things that I think are worthy of mention. One is IPS designed and constructed an Australian Inosonde. Now, an Inosonde is basically a radar, upward-looking radar, that reflects off the upper atmosphere and gives us an idea of the density of the ionosphere and how much it can support radio communications. But the Inosonde itself, the monitor that monitors the upper atmosphere, is something that is used around the world by groups such as ourselves that need to monitor that. And IPS designed and marketed such an Inosonde that was built in Australia by IPS and then handed over to industry in Australia to become a multi-million dollar industry. So we're very proud of that, and we're very proud of the fact that Inosonde has now become the most used Inosonde around the world. So we've played our part in monitoring space weather around the world.
And
medicine. Money for it too.
They're built by Australian industry then?
They are built by Australian industry in Melbourne.
Yes, because so many things developed in Australia just go overseas and get developed there.
Indeed. So it was a rewarding process to actually be able to hand that on to industry here and to see it run in such a successful way. Other things that I'd like to mention was the work that I've done with the International Telecommunications Union. The ITU is an organisation working under the United Nations, which produces standards for radio communications globally. So this, in other words, produces standards that allows for example, broadcasts in one country to be passed through other countries at the right frequencies in order to be received all around the world or in particular countries. It requires agreement between different nationalities about what frequencies should be used for what services. And my particular part was chairing the ITU Study Group 3, which looks after standards in radio wave propagation. I was chairman of that since 1997, and it allows Australia to have an input into ITU standard work, which is very valuable both for industry and for the use of radio communications and allocation of radio frequencies by the Australian government. So it's something that I think is worth noting. The other thing that's worth noting, I think, is software which IPS has produced, and again, it's used around the world. We often are being asked by various groups, whether it's United Nations, whether it's groups in America, Scandinavia, Japan, all wanting to use the IPS radio frequency management software, which we call the standalone prediction system. This was a system of predictions that we built along with many other people around the world. The fact that ours became and has become one of the three main systems globally is because we took what we considered was a good prediction model and then made it simple to use. So we built around it a user-friendly context, which meant that people got what they want from it and could handle the actual communication, the actual program itself, in a way which helped them rather than just producing numbers which they then had to later analyze. It's a very user-friendly system and still remains that. And we're, again, very proud of that. That's gone around the world.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Space Show, David.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And we look forward to keeping up with what you're doing in the future.
Thank you. Yes, I look forward to that.